I think a good place to start maybe would just be to tell us a little bit about the Evangelical Catholic and, you know, what your work is there and just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. The Evangelical Catholic we're a private nonprofit. We're based in Madison, Wisconsin, but we have people who live all over the country. And what we do is we form and equip Catholics to live out the Great Commission. And what that means, practically speaking, is primarily we partner with Catholic ministries. The vast majority of our partners are parishes, but we also partner with some dioceses. We partner with some other apostolates, and we partner with some campus ministries. And when we do that, we work typically with the ministry staff. We form and equip them with a vision for lay apostolate, lay holiness, and help them to recalibrate the way that they operate so that they can give formation to people and then accompany them in their vocation, the laity's vocation to sanctify the temporal order.
It's a mouthful. And tell us a little bit about yourself as well.
I'm a senior consultant at the EC. I've been with the EC since about 2011, 2012. EC's been around since like the late 90s. And my role as senior consultant is I do some consulting and some advising of ministries, but I also do a lot of experimental things and a lot of writing and a lot of speaking and teaching. So I right now we're starting to work with seminarians, and that's kind of my realm is figuring out seminary information, doing workshops for priests. That's usually my realm. Write articles, things like that. That's kind of me professionally. Personally, I've been married for 20 years, and we've got 8 kids, ranging from a sophomore in college down to 4 years old.
Nice. Nice. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the word apostolate, and you know, mm-hmm. I've been through the Reach More program, so I'm pretty familiar with what you guys mean by that. But for our listeners who maybe are less, you know, everyone I think has heard the term ministry at some point in their kind of church journey, whether it's even just at the parish level, or if they're familiar with more of a national ministry that caters to some need. But maybe people are less familiar with the word apostolate. And I know that you have a good kind of way to define those two against each other. Can you help us do that?
Sure. So kind of like under the church's overarching umbrella of mission or evangelization, you can distinguish between ministry and apostolate. And so if you were to do, let's say, a word search on the Vatican website and, you know, look at all the instances where you see the term ministry and then all the instances where you see in the term apostolate, you're going to see some trends. And the trend for ministry is that ministry flows from holy orders. It's something that's done officially, you could almost say professionally, publicly on behalf of the church. And it's ordered to the building up of the holiness and apostolate of the rest of the church. Okay. Apostolate generally refers to the lay vocation. Okay. So there's the apostolate of the church. Okay. The church being sent. Okay. So ministry, you could, what does that term literally mean? It means service. Okay. You're serving the people of God. Whereas apostolate comes from a word that means sent. So it's you're being sent. You're being sent to sanctify the temporal order, to preach the gospel to all of creation. In one way, that applies to everyone in the church, but in a more specific way, it refers to that which is proper to the laity. It flows from baptism and confirmation. And it's you could say, in a certain sense, the goal of the ministry of the church to build up the vast majority of the church for apostolate.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're basically saying that the clergy are called to minister to kind of the members of the church, and the mm-hmm. members of the church are called to minister to non-members of the church and the church. It's kind of together, the world at large.
Yeah. That's a way of putting it. You could say like ministry, generally speaking, is a little bit more ad intra, whereas apostolate is generally a little bit more ad extra. These aren't, of course, like airtight chambers. But yeah, that's about right.
And would you say that that's is part of your understanding informed by, you know, the Vatican II's universal call to holiness? Is that part of the mission of the Evangelical Catholic and you know, what we understand the work of in the apostolate to be?
Yeah, you know, in a certain sense, you could say that like the Second Vatican Council is, you know, you could say in a certain sense the birthplace of the new evangelization, though it has its roots prior to that, which is really kind of a recentering of the church's mission from the beginning, but precisely in core, more of like a post-Christian era, which is essentially, you know, the church re-examining herself and saying, "Hey, we need to be more effective at preaching the gospel." You know, at toward the end of the 20th century, you know, the bloodiest century of human history, the church kind of looked at herself and was saying, "Gosh, like, are we missing something here? Why did we just get done with the bloodiest, you know, century of human history? We need to re-examine ourselves. How can we be more effective?" And that's kind of like the one of the ways you could look at the thrust of the Second Vatican Council to be more effective at sanctifying the world. And so, a lot of it was doubling down on this vocation to apostolic holiness. There's a universal call to holiness right at the heart, Chapter 5, Lumen Gentium. And it's directed to the entire church, but the entire church is well over 99% lay faithful. And so what are the roles of the various members of the church with regard to this universal call to holiness and this universal call to sanctifying the world? And so at the EC, we exist to assist to serve the church in being more effective doing that.
Right. You mentioned specifically, you know, being effective at preaching the gospel. And John, you are highly involved in helping people to interpret what preaching means in their lives, you know, not necessarily just for clergy to do, which I hear some resonance in, you know, in kind of how you're defining that. What do you think, John?
I mean, one thing that we've kind of really doubled down on is the presence of preaching moments that exist for all people. I mean, sometimes preaching is a very loaded word because we automatically think, well, that's coming from the pulpit, that involves a priest, a deacon, and some type of minister in a formal setting. But preaching moments are things that happen every single day in so many different contexts. And basically, the way we're trying to kind of cultivate this, primarily with lay people, is that, you know, your experiences of how God has worked in and through your life, that story is an important story to share with others as a means of building hope for other people. That, you know, we are not doing this life alone, that God is ever present to us in and through the person of Jesus Christ, because everything is caught up in that reality. So that, you know, our worst sufferings and pains and trials all have some way of being able to reveal God's love, compassion, mercy through us in and through others. And sharing those stories are preaching moments, as we like to call them in the work that I've been doing. And that can definitely be applicable for a priest or someone who's formally preaching, but it's equally as applicable for someone who's doing something in a completely informal setting, just talking around the table with someone or in some other type of context where it's not highly ecclesial, let's say. But you know, the thing that I'm hearing, and I'm just kind of curious, when you're talking about sanctifying the world, what does that look like to you? Like what does that tangibly look like on the ground? Like
Yeah,
when
that's a
you're,
good question.
you know.
Yeah. So for the ordinary Christian, so this is part of the tricky part of the tricky part of it. I don't know how to say that. Is that materially speaking, it might not look any different than what anyone is doing, minus sin, okay? But the life of an ordinary Christian is materially just the life of an ordinary person, but transformed from the inside by divine love. And so this is part of the difficulty of developing an imagination for what this looks like. In one sense, it doesn't look any different than what someone is already doing, because holiness is primarily an immanent or interior activity, but it has a mysterious effectiveness that radiates outward, and somehow mysteriously, without anything being different, somehow mysteriously, everything is different. Okay. So what this could look like, it's going to look, I had a professor in grad school who just had a really interesting way of phrasing things. One time he said that holiness is all about the priority of relationships. So first of all, it's the priority of your relationship with God, which transforms everything on the inside, but now there's a priority of relationships on the outside. And so what this could look like is, I know a CEO of a large firm downtown who shows up to work early every Friday morning and makes breakfast for his colleagues. And that has attracted other people to show up early. And now they have conversations and they have real, authentic relationships. And he walks around from time to time and just steps foot in people's office when the door is open and just kind of chit chats with them. And he's generous with his time, he's selfless. He's always asking people about their life. And over the course of time, people come to know that he is a devout practicing Catholic and they share with him things, you know? Now this is all on the outside, right? And he works well with excellence. His prestige, his professional prestige is his bait. It's his work well done is his bait as fishers of men. His prestige is his podium for preaching the gospel, so to speak. It gives him credibility. There's something attractive about that. This is all externally manifested, but on the inside, he gets to daily mass, I think, several times a week. He lives a life of daily prayer. That means he has to get up a little earlier than everyone else so he can get his prayer in. He's got to finagle his schedule around, sends his kids to Catholic school. So there's a sacrifice there. There's all sorts of things. I think he plays basketball at lunch a couple days a week with other executives downtown. And I'm sure the way he plays basketball while being very, very competitive is also somehow different than what others are. And there's something attractive to that. I don't know if that helps, but I'm just trying to give a sense of how ordinary, I don't know, how extraordinary the ordinariness of our vocation can be.
And when we take that to, the level of billions of people around the world coming out of a century, another century of life, we might see a far less violent world if people were to act like that, because now, not because they were trying to affect a world of nonviolence, although that's a noble end, but because they're just trying to live their own personal relationship with Jesus as a light in the world, which of course then leads to nonviolence, because how could you possibly do violence to someone as you love them?
Or, taken another way, in our post-Christian culture, there's a lot of loneliness, there's a lot of isolation, there's a lot of anxiety. And when you're around a person who doesn't seem to be lonely, doesn't seem to be anxious, doesn't seem to be to live a life of alienation and whatnot. They exude peace and joy. I don't know. It's attractive. It appeals to everyone's desire for happiness. Somehow on the outside, nothing is different with his life than my life, but somehow everything about his life is different. What is that? What's going on there? What's going on in his life? that's the power of like a love transformed life that radiates. And now is when this person needs, I don't know, the courage and the gentleness and the tenacity and the words to be able to speak into that. This is what you call like maybe like the apologetics of meaning, right? So why do you live this way? What's up with your life? You know, or maybe they might not ask those questions. Maybe they just might come to you and ask for professional advice or something like that. But over time, that professional advice, because you're always giving good, consistent professional advice, maybe that turns into more personal advice and turns into a relationship.
In our study on discipleship, we asked mass attending Catholics in the US how they felt about, the skills they maybe lacked related to sharing their faith with others. Would you say that it's maybe not even about the skills so much as just how they're living their life in general? That maybe is what's lacking, and that it's just that it's not leading them into an organic relationship with others, which is maybe then the context for that faith sharing?
Yes. Okay. So while skills and techniques can be really helpful and are important, we have developed so much human wisdom and excellence that it would be a shame to not try to utilize it. But I would say that the skills and the trainings and the workshops are very secondary to holiness. They have to be within the context of personal holiness. Because if we reduce evangelization to something you can just train someone for, just a set of skills or a technique for saying something, we reduce evangelization to the manipulation of human techniques. And that kind of strips the church, that strips evangelization of its supernatural aim and of its supernatural power. We put it as, I think, is it, I don't know if it's one of the Psalms says something like, you know, it's like putting our trust in horses and chariots and charioteers. A well-made chariot and a strong horse is helpful. But we don't put our trust, our faith in that
If
solely.
you can't, if you don't have conversational skills, your relationship is going to suffer in other ways, regardless of if you're trying to evangelize, right?
Oh, totally.
So there's table stakes, but then there's also something more.
Yeah, and there's even a there, I think there's even a sense in which, you know, a lot of the skills and things are just a matter of human formation. You know, I work with a lot of seminarians, and one of the things that we'll kind of jokingly one of our mantras that we'll jokingly kind of shoot out there is don't be weird, right? Like, you know, your character, your personality. So this is human formation. Your character, your personality can either facilitate or be an impediment to the spreading of the gospel. And so those skills and whatnot are important. But I think the temptation is to put too much emphasis on trainings and workshops and skills as if you can just train people up into zeal, as if, you know, a worldly life can be made up for with a slick negotiation skill or the ability to like say the kerygma or lead a small group in a fun way, you know?
Peter, that's so interesting. Like, you talk about like don't be we weird, and I get that, and trust me, I it's something I would agree with. The interesting thing that I think about when as you were saying is like, there is clearly, if you're saying you're working with seminarians, there is a strong pocket, if not majority, of seminarians today who I think want to be weird because they want to actually. They want to show how countercultural it is to be a Christian. And
Sure.
that shows up in, it usually shows up in a lot of like liturgical stuff. So it shows up in how they emphasize liturgy, what they wear, how they wear it, just the role they see the priest playing within the society at large. And that there's something attractive to something that's so countercultural and so different in a world that's somehow very much filled with not tradition and being very loose and not kind of emphasizing the importance of symbolism and ritual and things like that. And you know, and so there is a very strong segment of a young seminarian who wants to be weird because they think that is attractive. You know, I think you know what I'm trying to get at.
Or
You
even
know,
that that's what the church is calling them to, right?
you know, and I think it's important to kind of understand what is it we're really talking about when we're saying this kind of stuff. I mean, because there, it. I was in. I've been a priest for like 10 years, and when I was in the seminary, I was 10 years older than most of the seminarians because I was a late vocation, as they say. And like, you know, I'm there scratching my head with these guys who are 10 years younger than me, thinking like, I don't think that stuff's going to really fly in lots of the circles that I walk in. And you know, for example, I teach at a Catholic school in San Francisco. Where like pretty much no one goes to church, no one has any type of real strong relationship with the church in a meaningful way. And I can guarantee you the smells and bells of the faith are not going to like captivate people. Like that doesn't work. They're not primed for that, you know? So I don't understand what are we doing? Like, what are you observing? What is EC doing in this type of context? Because if you have a bunch of seminarians coming in thinking that I'm just going to be really weird and that's going to be very captivating because it's going to be so darn countercultural, well, I can tell you like that doesn't work. Like that, at least you'll just attract other equally weird people. And that's if you want to do that, that's cool. But like I'm just kind of curious as to where do you set yourself out in this terrain that we're in. And this is, I'm not trying to be judgmental on anything. I'm just kind of curious as to really how you navigate through this. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's oh wow, yeah. So when we work with seminarians and we're just learning how to do this. So there's the pillars of priestly formation, this human formation, spiritual formation, theological formation, and pastoral formation. We typically fall in that realm of pastoral formation. And so what this looks like is how do you accompany people into practices of personal holiness and apostolate? And now, how do you do that with not just with individuals, but with a growing army of individuals? And then how do you begin to reframe the way your parish goes about doing ministries in a situation where the ministry structures aren't currently calibrated for this type of ministry, the ministry of accompanying people into personal apostolate and holiness? That stuff there that you're talking about is, you know, I would say that's more like human formation, liturgical formation. It's tricky. It really is because, okay, so it's hard to sift through. Like, you know, sometimes that stuff flows from just kind of a quirky personality. And as they grow in personal holiness without losing the quirks, somehow the holiness will sanctify the quirkiness and it will be endearing for some. Maybe that's a minority. I don't know. For some people, it's just a it's a manifestation of immaturity and they'll kind of grow out of that. Some gracefully, some it'll be real hard. And it's difficult, you know, because here's a pastoral principle. People receive things according to their disposition. And love obeys a law of gradualness. So how do you form people into, you know, just because we're here right now, how do you form people into being not weird without discouraging them, you know, raining down on their parade, you know, squashing what might be kind of like a legitimate, I don't know, honeymoon phase that is good to go through, you know? Yeah, that's tricky. We typically we don't address a lot of those types of things head on. It's more accompanying them into pastoral principles. So there's an intellectual component of pastoral formation, pastoral principles, and then helping them to acquire the an apostolic consciousness, attitudes, and then some skills.
What can you explain some of that? Like what are the principles? What are the skills? Like, can you like just or maybe just
Yeah,
give an example.
sure. So, example of a couple, principles, pastoral principles. That which is received according to the disposition of the receiver. Okay, so people receive things according to their disposition. I already said that one. That's a pastoral principle. You have to understand that, like, you can't talk to, you can't approach everyone in the same way, and not everyone is ready to be approached and invited into a season of in-depth apostolic holiness. Okay. So if you extend that out, you could say another pastoral principle that's built off of that one is if you work within your circle of influence, you'll be more fruitful. Whereas if you spend more time in your circle of concern, you're going to be less fruitful. So in other words, who are those? If you want to start a movement of renewal in your parish or in your community, step one, we could say, is forget about the parish. Okay. And I say that a little using hyperbole. What I mean by that is if you're distracted by all the things and all the people who are in your circle of concern, but not in your circle of influence, you are not going to be effective. Instead, you have to focus on a few, just like Jesus, on a mustard seed. Okay. And if you focus on a few who have the best disposition to receive this kind of formation that forms them for apostolic holiness in the middle of the world, you're going to be more fruitful. And now you have to be patient, right? You have to walk and accompany these people. And then as you develop so an initial formation period for these people might be several months long, because first of all, these people are already disposed to that type of formation to develop a more apostolic outlook. So now you, as the young priest or as the pastoral worker, you have to develop the time management, the emotional bandwidth, the relational skills to accompany these people, these five, six, seven, eight people. And now, while not at the end of that initial period, not just forgetting about them, but continuing to accompany them, now accompany a new group of people. And so now you have to work on expanding your bandwidth, more time management skills, more prioritization. You got to start pruning away things that are less fruitful. So that's I kind of went from principle, okay, that which is received and circle of influence, circle of concern, to a practical application. Now let's work with a few who are best disposed. I'm not going to try to cajole, the lukewarm in the pews into some sort of Wednesday evening program. I'm not going to try to cajole people off the streets into the pews. I'm not going to start with a big, huge event. I'm going to start with a small band of brothers who are well disposed to me and to this type of life. And then slowly, and this, as you could probably imagine, this takes years to acquire this approach and to build onto it.
So, how do you start? Or let's put it this way, how do you encourage someone to start?
Yeah. Well, in some ways it's very, very simple. At risk of being simplistic, you could say, well, if you're like, let's say, a pastoral worker or a parochial vicar or something like that, you could probably right now, offhand, think of a handful or so people who you would desire to have community with. Okay. It would be fun to go through some sort of, I don't know, some sort of book, some sort of study together with. Okay. And do that. Okay. Do that with some sort of solid Catholic resource. But I would say this, the conversation has to revolve around, I would say, three topics. Okay, no matter what book you're reading, no matter what study you're doing, again, this is on the simplistic end of things, revolves around life, growth, and mission. So you connect on life, and so you kind of know what's going on in each other's life, and you hang out, things like that. You connect on the level of growth, and you help each other to grow in personal prayer and holiness. And then you help each other to grow very personally in mission. So in other words, you're not just kind of growing here as a community, but you're helping each other to face outward. Who are the people in your life and in each other? So let's say the three of us are doing this together. We're checking in with, you know, we're making sure, for example, like one example could be, we're just making sure that at any given time, we always have 3 to 5 names on a list of people who we're praying and mortifying for. And then every, maybe once a month, we're checking in. Hey, did you text that person? Did you get together yet? So there's an apostolic focus. There's a missional focus to what we're doing together. That's on a simplistic end. You could extend this out. And at the EC, we've developed an approach and a curriculum that's calibrated to the secular vocation, and it has various components that are really helpful. So like there's a group component, there's a personal prayer guide, there are mission prompts, and there's a one-on-one accompaniment component. And then those components together with a progressive curriculum help to develop in people a consciousness of who they are as sons and daughters of God in the middle of the world, that my vocation is not to spend more and more and more time at my parish, but my vocation is to be salt, light, and leaven to my family, to my coworkers, to my friends. That most Catholics don't have a good imagination or good vision for their very own vocation. They think that becoming a better Catholic means looking more like a nun or a monk or a priest. Because part of that reason, there's a bunch of reasons why that is, but one of the reasons is because most of our examples of holiness are based on religious and clergy. And so, you know, if I really want to be holy, I should give everything up. If I really want to be holy, I should go to a monastery. If I really want to be holy, I need to live poverty, chastity, and obedience. And a lot of that doesn't translate readily into someone's life who, you know, has to make a lot of money because they got a big family.
Right.
You know?
It's so bizarre too, because like, you know, being on this other side of the altar, so to speak, being as a priest, my heroes are not priests, nuns, and monks. I mean, and I've spent a lot of time in those circles. It's like my models of holiness actually are the people who are raising the 8 kids, and who are juggling so many different responsibilities and living tremendous lives of sacrifice. So, you know, it's such a poor representation of understanding what holiness is when you're looking at priests, nuns, and monks who live a life that's been institutionalized for them to kind of be able to not necessarily have to make a lot of personal decisions that involve a personal holiness. I mean, to be perfectly honest. I think that we're at a time right now where we have to reevaluate all of these things, because what is the Spirit speaking to the church at this moment in time? We've already said, like, you know, the Second Vatican Council in a lot of ways is just grappling with just the bloodiness of the 20th century in so many ways. But like, you know, let's push it even further. I mean, like, what does it really look like to live a type of life truly believing that, you know, our lives are not our own, that, you know, suffering, it does not mean that somehow we've been punished by God or rejected, and that holiness isn't simply involving just becoming more ecclesiologically centric or something like that. I mean, there has to be something very real and a certain type of gravitas to what an encounter with God, with Christ looks like, and what a life of faith looks like, that's not so systematized in some type of way of checking some types of boxes of some sort. So it's just a very interesting time that we live in. And I just don't know. I don't know what it looks like. And that's why I'm asking these questions, because I'm like, this it, something has to change for us off. It has to give. Like, business as usual does not work, and for example, I'm almost like hesitant to try to get someone to come to church, because I'm like, I don't know what they're going to be walking into when they go into a church. Like what's going to happen there? Are they going to be welcomed, or are they going to be automatically judged for, why are you wearing your shorts in this place or something like that? I mean, like, all those things. Like, you can't lean into the institution in any way, shape, or form, thinking that somehow all churches are the same, they're all so accepting, and they could do all these wonderful things, and it doesn't matter what's happening, because at the end of the day, you're going to receive Jesus in the Eucharist, and isn't that amazing? Like that form of doing holiness, completely irrelevant in people's lives that I encounter. It's just I don't even feel like even talking about it, because it's just irrelevant, just completely irrelevant.
A couple things. I want to, well, you said a lot there, and I want to comment on a few of those. So first of all, you said something's got to give. Something will give. I guarantee it, because Pope John the 23rd, Pope Paul the 6th, John Paul the 2nd, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, every holy father in the last half century has called for it to happen, and there's an ecumenical council called on it, and unless unless you think that the Holy Spirit somehow left the church, which he didn't, it's going to happen, right? So it's something's going to give, and that's exciting. I think we're actually living in a really exciting,
I agree.
adventurous time. So the holiness of the religious and the clergy and the saints. So first of all, the canonized saints are absolutely, you could say, infallible examples of holiness. Not that what they taught was infallible, but their lives are infallible examples of holiness. Okay. And they are wonderful, beautiful, legit, examples of holiness. However, it's a holiness that doesn't translate readily to the lay state. That's where the rub is, right? And so the problem happens when lay people try to just tr try to imitate that. It that's where the rub hits, right? They either begin to look irrelevant, and that's not attractive to most people, or they themselves are like, God, this just doesn't fit with my life. It doesn't work, right? And so the holiness of religious and clergy and the witness of religious are always and ever irrelevant. We need them. We're going to have them till the end of time. They just emphasize, they emphasize the not yet rather than the already. What we need today. And perhaps there's an overemphasis on it, right? There's perhaps an overemphasis that clouds our imagination. Part of the difficulty of developing an imagination for this ordinary holiness, and by ordinary holiness, I don't mean mediocre. What I
No,
mean
I
is
get it.
extraordinary love lived in the ordinary everyday life. Part of the difficulty is that our vocation as the lay faithful is precisely to pass unnoticed. Like, that's our vocation. The vocation of religious is to pass noticed. They wear a habit, and they live out of the world, and they re-enter the world. And it's obvious when they re-enter the world, because wow, there's some like long flowy habits, and that's kind of cool or whatever. Like, there's a little esoteric attractiveness that some people have to that, and that's great. And that's the reason for the habit is precisely because of that kind of like otherworldly attractiveness. But that's not for most people, right? To live that life isn't for most people. For most people is to live a life that's kind of outwardly speaking, it's not esoteric looking and it's not obvious. And it's meant to pass unnoticed. And so when a person actually really is living that life of holiness, they are probably passing unnoticed because they aren't doing anything that's unusual, annoying, or strange that would draw a ton of attention to themselves until you get to know them. And then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, wow, something's different there. And these are the people who will have, 5,000 people attend their funeral when they die because of all the lives they've touched. But that's the part of the challenge that we have today in our parishes is rekindling. No, I don't know if that's the right word. Is reimagining or just, I don't know. I don't know how to say it. Part of the difficulty is casting this vision for heroic sanctity and apostolate in the middle of the world. The sublimity of the lay vocation. And here's the problem: we're not doing it very well in our parishes. I mean, at the EC, I think we're doing it very, very well. And I think if you were to call up our parishes, they would. I'm pretty confident they would concur. But part of the difficulty in just the parishes in general is that if you don't have a clear imagination or a clear vision for the lay vocation, if you don't know what it looks like, you can't give formation for it. And if you can't give formation for it, whatever you're giving is not going to be relevant to the people who are in the pews.
So let's put some meat on those bones. Obviously, one of the hardest things about doing spiritual growth work is that a lot of it happens in the interior, which is, not necessarily visible to the outside. Like you said, there are signs, but it's pretty interior. Or the fruits are taking a long time to grow or taking even longer to be eaten by someone and enjoyed. But you've been with EC for long enough that maybe you have a story of someone who went through something, some kind of formation program that you guys had long ago, and you've maybe seen their fruits throughout the years. Do you have any stories of kind of over a while of someone really kind of coming into their own holiness, I guess, however that looks?
One story that just always comes to my mind is so when people think of evangelization, they typically think of something you do at or for the parish. Okay. And in our formation, we try to steer away from that. We try to help you reimagine that your apostolate, your evangelization doesn't happen on the parish's turf, it happens on your turf. Okay. You might get called to help with something, but that's very, very, very secondary, if not tertiary. So there's a guy who went through our formation and he was a major airline pilot and he spends a lot of time in the air. And so he's like, I can't do like a traditional apostolic thing. I can't lead a small group. I can't do those sorts of things. And so my apostolate is going to be the cockpit. I'm going to have very intentional conversations with my co-pilots and with the flight attendants. And this has led to people opening up to him, stories of broken marriages and hurt relationships. I think it's led to a couple of people coming back to Mass. So it's just a consistent example of life well lived and then being very intentional about conversations. So here, maybe here's a little practical piece, right? So in the catechism, it says that it is impossible to pray at all times if you don't pray at specific times, consciously willing it. Okay. So, pray at all times. Okay. That there's the command. I think Jesus and Saint Paul both said that. In the catechism says you can't do that unless you pray at specific times, consciously willing it. Well, I would say since apostolate is just the radiation, the communication of personal holiness. You could say the same thing for apostolate. Live apostolate at all times, but it is impossible to live apostolate at all times if you don't do apostolate at specific times, consciously willing it. So one of the things that we do in our formation is we make sure to help. The exercise is called Define, Plan, Act. So get specific, get concrete, so that you can name an apostolic project or an apostolic focus. So for this guy, it was, my apostolate is my cockpit. And he probably got more specific than that. You know, he probably had, typically the exercise has you name 1 to 3 people and then start praying for them and sacrificing for them and things like that. So that for anyone that's listening, that's a really great way to take a very concrete step forward in being more apostolic. And really what happens is that it's in a certain sense, it's almost more about you than other people. Got to hear me the right way here. It's obviously about other people because your apostolate is simply loving. It's just loving other people. But in doing that, you have to grow more selfless. You have to grow more self-aware. How am I carrying myself? Do I have any weird, bad habits that are annoying? Am I coming across too strong with this person? Am I being a counter witness in any way? And then you're putting loving thought into how can I serve this person more readily? How can I be a light in this person's life?
Right. So right. That's the right posture, because I think when you don't give that nuance, it can sound like, okay, my agenda is I got to convert this person and I'm going to do whatever it takes. And like, they're my project now because I have something they don't have. And that's right. That's where I think evangelization goes all wrong. But I think that's a lot of the way people hear it in the church.
Totally.
So I appreciate that self-focus. It's actually giving to be able to work on yourself so that you can be that person of love for the other.
Yeah. Because really, I mean, at the end of the day, holiness and apostolate are the same reality. You know, we distinguish them conceptually, but at the end of the day, it's, you know, when I am trying to be more cheerful at home as an act of love for my wife and kids, am I growing in holiness or am I being more apostolic with them?
Mm-hmm. Why would there be a difference?
Thing. Yeah.
And that's a great example too, because presumably your wife and kids are also Catholic. But everybody needs to be evangelized all the time, right? We're always coming into a deeper relationship.
Right. And as you grow, as that zeal, as that love burns more deeply on the inside, and as you begin to kind of order your exterior life a little bit better, you know, perhaps the Lord is going to put people in your life and he's going to call you to a place where you are going to actually become more organized with certain things and start a guys group or a ladies group or something like that. But you see, in that case, the priority of relationships takes place. You have to talk it over with God first. And then you got to talk it over with your spouse. Hey, you know, this, I'm thinking about doing this a couple times a week a couple times a month. And then you got to work on those relationships with those other people. And then you always have to be checking in with your spouse. Hey, am I around enough? Am I spending too much time with the guys? So the like fingers of a hand that grow together, when you work on one apostolic focus, you know, it all grows together.
Religion to Reality is an initiative of DeSales Media created by me, Dave Pliske, and is produced and edited by Connor Donnelly. If you found value in our conversation, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you love the show, ratings and reviews go a long way toward letting others know about the show. Go to religiontoreality.org for more details and resources.